You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, actor Hugh Bonneville has won dozens of awards. His face has global recognition thanks to his starring role on Downton Abbey. The Earl of Grantham joins the show today at 6 on 1A+. Now, when you think about your health, you might think of individual choices and treatments, your diet and exercise habits, prescriptions and procedures when you get sick, the stuff you talk to your doctor about. But there's another side to health, public health, the things that can affect huge numbers of people, whether that's air and water quality, access to preventive care, affordable and healthy food, or warning systems to help spot the spread of new infectious diseases. Our next guest is a doctor working with individual patients. But he sees a big problem. An overwhelming share of health spending in the U.S. goes to individual health, not as much goes to public health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How often do you think about the concept of public health? Do you think we need wider interventions, changes to help stop problems before they cause that visit to the doctor's office? Did COVID-19 change the way you think about the way we think about health in the United States? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Michael Stein is professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. He's the author of over a dozen books and executive editor of Public Health Post. His newest book is called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. Dr. Stein, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Last time I talked to you, we were talking about your book where you talk to your patients about their money and their struggles in some cases with money and how that affected their health. Can you talk about that and what started you down this road of thinking more about public health more generally?
Yeah, I'm a primary care doctor. I see people one by one in my office. I'm also a researcher and I moved recently to a public health school and began to think about things outside of my office and the larger world, right? So I grew up and was taught in my medical training and also just as growing up in the United States that we have powerful ideas about individualism. And we think of our lives as individual journeys, we make our own career success and failure, and we're self-absorbed in the pursuit of happiness. And so that, of course, leads to the optimization of health. And so we believe that we're responsible for and can change our health. We can eat better, we can sleep more, we can exercise. And that's what I call the me part of this story. Well, the public health asks something very different of us, right? It asks us to think of others. It asks us to think of us. It asks us to think of America as a group project where the benefits might not come to us immediately or specifically, but rather to all of us, including our kids and our grandkids. So public health really is a different framework of thinking about the world. And that's what I've been writing about recently.
And in the book, you look at the investment in the me side of things, you know, the healthcare versus the us side of things, the public health. Can you lay out which side of the seesaw is getting pressed into the dirt?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So the truth is that in the United States, we spend $3 to $4 trillion a year on health care, medical care. That is going to our doctors, emergency rooms, into the hospital, getting CAT scans, getting blood tests, paying for our medications. That's healthcare. We're very familiar with it. When you talk to somebody at a barbecue or at Thanksgiving dinner and say, tell me about your health, I imagine within 15 seconds, they'll be talking about their doctor. That's not what public health is. It is larger things that we're going to talk about. But what we know is that per American per year, we spend $11,000 on healthcare. And per American per year, we spend $280 on public health. So 40 times less on public health than we do on healthcare. And there are lots of reasons for that. But because we spend less money on it, we take it less seriously, we know less about it. And that's a problem. I believe that that's a deep, deep problem for Americans and for our kids and grandkids to come.
Now, if it was working great, that might not be a problem. What do we find when we compare the healthcare outcomes or the health outcomes here in the U.S. versus comparable income countries?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. Thank you. the idea of life expectancy is one we can all understand. We think of it as sort of a population of people, maybe in our family, maybe in our neighborhood, maybe in our town or state. Certainly as a country, we understand what life expectancy is. We expect to live a certain number of years as a group. The other way to think about it is, you know, what are my chances of living to the age of 70? That's how another way we think about life expectancy. Now, I consider life expectancy a beautiful metric of public health. It is sort of a group metric. And what we know is that in the 1990s, the average life expectancy in the United States was about the same as anywhere in developed countries in Europe. Germany, Norway, Spain, England, we were about the same. And now we are considerably worse than all of Europe. We're about 40th in the world in life expectancy at this point, even though we like to think of Americans as exceptional. We're 40th, which means that, you know, an American baby born today is more likely to die before they turn 5, and an American teenager today is more likely to die before they turn 20, and an American adult is more likely to die before they turn 70 than any place in Europe. That is, Europe has better life outcomes than us across the board. That's for whites and blacks in high poverty areas and low poverty areas. That's a shocking statistic if you really believe that America is exceptional, and I think it's unacceptable.
Talking to Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. We're talking about his new book. It's called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Malik is with us in Green Bay. Malik, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, the impacts to public health and even public health initiatives, if something like universal health care were to ever pass, how things like that might change, you know, from an initiative standpoint.
Malik, thanks for the call. Dr. Stein, universal health care as a way, at least, to address health care access.
Yeah, Malik, thanks for the question. The universal health care, I would consider in health insurance or access to care, which comes through insurance in the United States, as a part of public health. I would consider it a small part of public health. It is an important part of public health. And I think a real moral question for the United States, why we have 10% of our population who is uninsured, hesitant to get care, likely to be bankrupted if they actually have a medical event. Those are sort of moral and important access questions. In terms of whether our life expectancy would change if those 10% of people had health care, is probably a small amount. I don't think that that's what's driving our low life expectancy in the United States, but I do think it's an important political question, something that I believe in entirely, that everybody should have a right to health care. And an important thing to bring up, but not central to public health. Mm-hmm. Again, health care distinguished from public health.
Malik, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Dr. Stein, can you give an example where you think an investment in public health could really help us tackle a particular problem, one of those things that really is bringing our life expectancy, holding it back?
Yeah, so let's talk about, let's choose one of our big ongoing problems, which I would say is overweight or obesity. So obesity has gotten worse in the past 50 years in the United States, right? So this notion of the me view of the world, right, which is maximize my health, maximize self-interest, and that will produce a better future for all of us, hasn't really worked out. And the paradigm case for that is obesity. So we spend billions of dollars on diet books. We enroll in diet programs. We now have medications for obesity. We do surgery for obesity. We've tried lots of medical things, and yet we're worse off than we were 50 years ago, such that nearly half of our population is obese, which, as you know, drives diabetes and heart disease and therefore premature death. Well, why is that? Is it because really 50% of our population just has no willpower and is just weak people who in the individual view of the world are unsuccessful? I don't think so. I don't think that that's how we're ever going to get out of the obesity problem. The problem of obesity, even for people who are dieting, is that we all live in a world where food and food systems are dictated by large companies that call the production, the processing, the distribution, the preparation, and the consumption of food in America. And those systems are shaped by social and cultural systems that we live in and do things like have policies such as corn and sugar subsidies. And when you have corn and sugar subsidies in your country, you have the cheapest food having corn and sugar in it, which is high calorie food, which is why when we go to the supermarket, we're deluged with difficulties in keeping to a diet. So all of this is a long way of saying that the world that we live in, the policies that we've allowed to drive our food systems, is what's driving obesity. And that's not an individual decision. It is at the end of the road, but it's really hard. And so if you want a good public health, then you want to set up a system of the world, of the economic and social and cultural world, such that it's easy for people to maintain their health. And with food, we've done exactly the opposite, and we're in trouble because of that. And that trouble will only be solved by large policies, I believe, and many of them. There's no single simple answer to obesity in America, but I believe it's driven by policies. And I keep using that word policies because when you're dealing with populations, as we talk about in public health, policies matter.
We're talking about public health and individual health care in the U.S. Our guest is Dr. Michael Stein from Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for our guest, if you think that there is a public health intervention that you'd like to see that you think could make a big difference, maybe something you've seen in your own community, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. His new book is Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. He says too much of our spending is going toward individual health care, not enough toward public health, things that could prevent a lot of those trips maybe to the doctor's office. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Ruth is with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yes, hi. Public health is a lot about preventing illness and individual illness and broader group illness. When you're dealing with prevention, you're in a world where you have to be able to prove or talk about how certain things didn't happen because you put things into place. So more people didn't get ill because you put masks on, for example, or some other intervention. How do you see, Dr. Stein, how do you see getting that concept out into the public to be broader understood?
Great question, Dr. Stein.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Public health is about prevention. It's one of the three P's that I've talked about for what is public health, right? Which is prevention across an entire population. The second P is that population. And the third P is policies. And you're talking really about sort of messaging. Like, how do we prove to people that we've had a benefit? And it's a great question. And the answer is maybe it's around things like coming up with analogies. So let's think about sort of the general public good. We believe in the public good in certain parts of our lives, like fire departments, right? We have fire departments that are, we pay for through our taxes in most cases, in most towns. And we believe in fire departments, and we want fire departments to take care of us when things arise. And we want fire departments to limit the amount of problems when they notice a problem. And fires don't go away. If you shut your fire department down, you wouldn't get rid of fires. You would just have bigger fires. So fire departments are important because they let us have a public good that we've invested in. But in addition to that, we have over the years invested in fire prevention, right? We have better wiring. We have different materials for our houses. So we do a variety of things that say, well, we're going to keep fires down through the materials that we use, and we're going to keep a public service up through a fire department. And we have to do the same thing around public health. We have to think of it as a fire department defending a public good that has elements of prevention and elements of surveillance and elements of early intervention. And all of those things are done by our public health departments. And we need to understand what our public health departments do, which I don't think we do in the United States very well, because we have a confusing public health system, and we need to sort of be aware of that.
Talking to Dr. Michael Stein about his new book, Me Versus Us, A Health Divided. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Andrew on the line now in Heartland. Andrew, hi.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I had a quick question for Dr. Stein. I'm a neurosurgeon, and we've been seeing more and more young kids dying from heroin overdose here in Waukesha. I think our last numbers are about 11 a month, which is really scary. I think there is an epidemic of drugs, and I agree with him 100% in that this is all about policy, and I think we've been very lame in regards to tightening our belts and trying to make better policy regarding illegal drugs. And what I'm seeing more and more is us liberating this, specifically now with marijuana, that all we know as of now is a way to introduce the young population into drugs and into stronger drugs. I mean, my stand on it is very simple. I would say absolutely no illegal drugs, and that includes marijuana. But from the policy point of view, Dr. Stein, what would you suggest we do? How do we tackle?
Andrew, thanks for the call. Dr. Stein, what would be your a public health approach to especially the drugs that are causing those overdoses?
Yeah, so if you look again at life expectancy in the United States, what you see is we have lost 2.5 years of life expectancy in the last 3 years. That is a historical record for us going backward. It's just terrible news. And part of the contribution to that is the growth of drugs. We have 100,000 people dying of opioid overdoses in the United States per year at this point, the highest ever. We also have more than 100,000 people dying every year of a legal drug called alcohol in America. And we have another 100,000 dying of cigarettes, nicotine, another legal drug in the United States. So there's a combination of what I would call avoidable mortality by coming up with policies, and they're complicated. They're not simple, that will try to minimize deaths from these particular causes in the United States, along with gun violence and accidents. These are the reasons why our life expectancy has dropped and was dropping even before COVID, clearly made worse by COVID. So these are complicated policies, but it's not just about opioids and prescription drugs. It's really about alcohol and cigarettes as well still.
Andrew, thanks for that call. Dr. Stein, you also write in the book that there's not always a financial incentive to take a public health approach. I could write a diet book. I probably won't, but I could potentially make a lot of money for me by doing that. Advocating for a public health change to tackle obesity, there's not really a strong profit motive. How much of an obstacle is that?
Obstacle, right? When we get the private sector involved in any part of our society, things move faster. We're an innovative country. And the question is how to do that in the public health arena. which is a product that ends up being very local. So it's hard to make money when you have hundreds of public health departments, because as you know, Rob, in the United States, we have city health departments and county health departments and state health departments, and we don't have a federal health department. And so to how to make money across all of those health departments, which are typically government entities interested in large communities, there's not a clear way to do that. There are some investment vehicles now that are bringing private equity into public health in small ways. It hasn't really caught on yet in the United States. It may well in certain ways, but in general, public health, because it deals with large swaths of the population, becomes a government project. And that's right. And that is the way it will be done in the United States over the next decade. But we're also, of course, at a time when we distrust government, and our government moves slowly, certainly at the federal level, at the state level as well. So it's hard to, again, engage at full speed here at a moment where we distrust and feel divided. So it's a tough way, and I don't think that our private sector is going to bail us out of this one.
Dr. Stein, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Michael Stein, professor and chair of health law, policy, and management at the Boston University School of Public Health. He talked with us today about his new book. It's called Me Versus Us, A Health Divided, looking at investment in and lack of investment in, he says, public health here in the United States. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll answer a Wisconsin question about the state's 1849 abortion law, which is now back in effect, and look back at the politics and culture of the time that led to that law being passed in the first place. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get some great recipes for pasta dishes, some simple, some fancy, all delicious, that and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, social media is changing as some of the biggest platforms like Meta, aka Facebook, are falling behind in popularity. We'll talk to an expert about what apps are on the rise and how social media has changed. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, civil discourse has turned pretty uncivil in a lot of American politics. We'll get a preview of a UW-Madison conference looking for ways to change that here in Wisconsin. First, the way we use social media platforms and the platforms themselves are changing. Facebook has had slower than planned growth, and its parent company Meta has seen a more than 60% decrease in value. And Twitter faces an uncertain future after its purchase by Elon Musk. Apps like TikTok and those promoting authenticity like Be Real are gaining popularity, especially among teens. We're taking the pulse of the social media world, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you go to one or more platforms on a regular basis? Do you like that you go to those platforms, or you just feel kind of hooked on them at this point? Has the way you use social media changed over the years or in recent months? What do you see family members, kids, your seniors using? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, if that's one of the platforms you use. Steve Knoll is marketing instructor at Madison College and a close observer of the social media landscape. Steve, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me again, Rob.
There are a zillion moving parts. Steve, what do you have your eye on these days?
Well, other than Twitter, let's not talk about that right now.
Sure.
It has been interesting to see what's going on with Facebook and specifically Meta, as they call themselves. You know, over the pandemic, usage of both Facebook and Instagram went up, including a lot of revenue, because advertisers realized it was a great medium to reach people while they're at home. But now that people have been journeying back out into the world, journeying back out into physical stores, revenue is down for the company. And that's kind of a concerning for them, is coming out of the pandemic, how this is affecting their business model. You know, it's the pandemic really upended everything, but a lot of companies, I think, are going to have to go through an adjustment period as we kind of get back to, you know, what used to be called normal.
when we talk about social media, I mean, Facebook, I'm looking at the chart of the biggest platforms. Facebook is number one, close to 3 billion users worldwide, yep, according to Facebook. You know, it's the biggest game in town. They were looking at maybe incredible growth to go on and on and on forever. They're not getting smaller when it comes to the number of users, but that growth has slowed down pretty significantly, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is definitely related to post-pandemic consumer habits. You know, online shopping is down. People are enjoying, you know, real-world shopping again. They're not going to stop online shopping. But the idea of scrolling through Facebook and seeing that weird little product that you can order, you know, a lot of that stuff that was so popular over the pandemic has just evaporated. And really now just more traditional advertisers have been kind of left with Facebook, which is still a lot. It's still a giant audience. And you have to remember the demographic of Facebook tends to be older. We're talking, you know, people 40 plus, 50 plus, and that demographic does have a lot of spending money. So even though, you know, their numbers are down, they're still going to be, they're going to be fine. You know, I think this is really just more of an adjustment from the post-pandemic era than any type of, you know, long-term trend that they may be experiencing.
And the parent company of Facebook now, it's called Meta. And yep, part of the deal there is they're creating the virtual reality social media platform of the future. How's that going so far?
It depends on who you ask. So, you know, the big barrier is the hardware. You know, they do have, well, what was originally called the Oculus headset. And if you're into virtual reality, it's a really fun tool, mostly for gaming. But it is a very interesting way to interact with, you know, people from literally all over the world in a kind of pseudo physical environment. They have since renamed it the Meta headset. That's caused some confusion since Oculus was a pretty good brand name for people who are into all that stuff. But I really think they're playing the long game with this. You know, they're not really looking at a metaverse emerging in the next few years. They're really looking at in the next few decades as the technology becomes easier to use, lighter, more like putting on a pair of reading glasses than putting on a clunky headset. So I think maybe in 10 years, yeah, I think instead of surfing somebody's Instagram feed, you will more like immerse yourself into someone's Instagram feed. But I still think we're quite a ways away from that actually happening.
Talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at the ever-changing landscape of social media. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your experience, your bit of data, if you will. What do you use? What have you stopped using? Have you avoided the whole thing altogether? Has it turned you away for some reason? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Steve, let's jump down the list a little bit to TikTok. Mm-hmm. About 1 billion users worldwide. That's not nothing.
Yep.
That's quite a bit. A lot, it seems like a lot of interest among younger people in particular, and people tend to use it for bigger chunks of time, and advertisers, if I understand correctly, kind of like that.
They do. The one thing about TikTok, it's kind of closer to something like YouTube than it is to something like Facebook or Instagram, where it's almost its own entertainment channel as much as it's a social medium. So that's really attractive to advertisers because the more time that people spend using on something, the more comfortable they are taking that little brief commercial break. So advertisers definitely kind of like how that connects. The one drawback to TikTok is that it does skew very young. It's very much a, you know, teenagers, 20-something dominated group. You know, once you really get past the 25, 30-year-old demographic, you know, those numbers are on there, but those users drop significantly in numbers. So it does come back to the advertising thing and what companies really are going after that 20-year-old demographic. You know, that's the one negative on TikTok. It's very popular. It's a lot of time is spent on it, but the number of businesses out there that really could benefit from using it as an advertising tool is fairly narrow. But you have to remember, TikTok has another business model. You know, ultimately, it is, you know, connected to, you know, the Chinese government. They're collecting your user information specifically to show you ads for Chinese made products. You know, TikTok was really built as a way to connect people to Chinese made products. And that's been a very controversial thing about TikTok. And while they've taken, especially the American version of TikTok has taken, you know, a lot of steps to kind of separate that, that still is a big revenue model for TikTok. They're getting money from China just to run the app. So TikTok doesn't really need to be as heavily relied on advertising as the other social medias do.
And that's a wild card. I mean, we see the FBI director testifying before Congress that they have national security concerns about the company's ties with the Chinese government. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher joined up with Senator Marco Rubio saying we need legislation to out-and-out ban TikTok. I don't know if a ban will happen, but some kind of a new regulation, it seems very likely.
Well, yeah, I think a ban is just not realistic. But yeah, that's the thing is, this app is what's referred to as a data scraper. You know, once you download it onto your phone, when you give it permission to use, nobody ever reads the terms of the user agreement. You know, the app does have access to other things on your phone, you know, photos, other apps, other data. And there's a question as to how much it really gets. Does it get into your bank account? Does it read your emails? You know, all this other stuff. There are a lot of like questions about that have not been answered. So, you know, as much as, you know, I think TikTok in the grand scheme of things is relatively harmless, because really, if they're collecting data on you, it's to pair you up with Chinese made products. It's not necessarily to hack your identity or anything like that. So it's a little malicious, but certainly there are other apps out there that are extremely dangerous. But TikTok is more cautious than dangerous.
We're talking to Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College, about changes in social media usage and the apps themselves. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you check Facebook daily? Do you post a lot? Do you used to use it a lot more and now you've faded or even gotten out of it altogether? If you are on Twitter, are you getting off Twitter, given big changes there? Do you watch things on TikTok or YouTube, a very big social media platform we haven't talked about? Let us know how you relate to social media. Do you think it's bad for you, or do you worry about how it affects kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College, with us today to talk about how some people are starting to use social media differently, the rise and fall, or at least the decline, of various platforms. And you can join in with your own story. 800-642-1234. Do you use social media differently than you used to? More? Less? What's changed for you? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Miles joins us now in Green Bay. Miles, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Miles?
I just wanted to mention a change that I've kind of seen across social media, especially in places like YouTube, where I think it had become a really good place, and it still is a really good place to get good information and find like tutorials and stuff, and you know how to do everything from fix your furnace to something else. But I feel like as we've seen more and more people go to it and try to find ways to like monetize their content, I feel like it's just getting harder and harder to find meaningful information. Like, I don't think you can find a video that's shorter than 10 minutes these days. And I'm guessing that all has to do with how it's monetized and how many ads they can serve you. And people that are making good content are burying 30 seconds of good information in a 10-minute video. And sometimes I just give up lately and go back to trying to find written sources and stuff like that.
Interesting, Miles. Thanks a lot for the call. Steve Miles using YouTube, like a lot of people, for fix-it advice and things like that. What are you watching for with changes at YouTube? There have been that you can see right on their front page lately.
Well, Miles absolutely nailed it with that one. Is TikTok, YouTube recently changed how people who are posting videos and monetizing it get paid. There's now a minimum amount of minutes per month as well as a minimum amount of videos they have to upload. And as a result, you're right, like a 1 minute tutorial has to be stretched out to a certain length just so they can monetize it. This is why I mentioned TikTok first. A lot of people have gravitated to TikTok for tutorial information because there's a lot of 30-second, 1 minute how to do things all over TikTok. That's actually a very, very popular use of that app. And it seems like that it's really supplanting YouTube as a place to go for quick little pieces of information. I myself, you know, have really stopped going to YouTube when I'm trying to, you know, learn a piece of software or something. And instead I'll look it up on TikTok and I find, you know, just as good information, but 30 seconds. I don't have to sit through the other 9.5 minutes of fluff to get what I need.
Thanks a lot for that call, Miles, at 800-642-1234. Christopher joins us now in Delavan. Christopher, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just wanted to make the comment about, you hear a lot about these studies that show that people who, you know, spend time on social media apps, there's a, like, seems to be a relation with, like, depression and, negative attitudes and feelings and stuff like that. And also, I just wanted to, add on to what Miles was talking about with how, and it ties in my comments as well, that the monetization of these social media platforms, they don't, their goal isn't to put, like, correct information forward or the concern about their users. It's just about, how can we get the most ads shown? How can we generate the most money? And, stuff like that is a good example.
Christopher, thanks a lot for the call. Steve, we have seen concern about, people who end up engaging or spending a lot of time on social media may not feel great about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been studies about the psychological addiction of social media. It's definitely a real thing. But there's also people who spend, hours and hours in front of the television. That's been going on for decades. And there really isn't any different than somebody, spending, just hours just watching TV shows left and right than there is on social media. They're all forms of psychological addictions that are related to depression issues. So I think that, it's definitely a concern, but it's really, it's not anything we haven't seen before. I think all mediums will have some type of addictive quality to them. And, that does kind of cross over into the other part about advertising as well. Ironically, it's the users of the social media who are demanding these ads because nobody is willing to pay for a social media app. They have done many studies saying, would you pay $10 a month to get, a social media app with no ads? And virtually no one will agree to do that. YouTube offers an ad-free subscription plan. I think it's about $15 a month. And very few people take advantage of that. So, in one hand, people say all these social media companies don't care. All they do is they exist to show ads. But on the other hand, it's really the fault of the consumer because these social media companies are businesses. They have to make money somehow. And if consumers aren't willing to subscribe, the other business model is an advertising supported model. And overwhelmingly, consumers have said they prefer an advertising social media business model infinitely more popular than a paid subscription model. And that's just how it's going to be until people start signing up into the few subscriptions that are out there. Until they really start gaining traction, that's not going to change.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about the changing landscape of social media with Steve Knoll from Madison College. All right, Steve, you made me put it off till later. Let's talk about Twitter. Now, not one of the biggest networks out there compared to a Facebook, much smaller user base, but kind of outsized influence in some ways because of a lot of politics and media congregates there, I think, just bought by Elon Musk with some other investors. We could spend 2 hours talking about it. What are you watching for at Twitter in particular, though?
I was going to say, Elon Musk bought Twitter. I hadn't heard about that. So, you're right. Twitter in the is much smaller in terms of the user base. But what makes Twitter really unique is it's one of the few social media that really is a real-time medium. You know, something being posted on Twitter 20 minutes ago is considered yesterday's news for practical purposes. And that's really what makes Twitter unique is the speed of how information travels, good or bad, because obviously we've seen that, you know, incorrect, false information can also travel at the speed of light on Twitter. So, but, you know, I think that the medium itself is very interesting. Now, what Elon Musk is doing is that's been the real head scratcher because all signs seem to point that he bought this on a whim and doesn't really have a business plan. And now maybe he does, and this is some brilliant behind the scenes marketing plan to keep attention on it. Wow. If that's true, he really is the most brilliant person ever. But so far, it really seems to be a bit of a dumpster fire. You know, it's they're changing things every day, sometimes every hour. They're announcing things and then rolling it back. You know, it's in one way, I find it really fascinating to watch, but it is kind of like watching, you know, a train wreck in slow motion. You know, the big question is how long can it financially survive? If I was running paid advertising campaigns on Twitter, I absolutely would suspend them. It's too volatile. It's too unpredictable. And you can just see it, you know, as somebody who's been using Twitter for 10 years myself, Twitter, what it looks like this week is radically different than what it looked like last week, just in terms of what's being posted and what's not being posted. And it's interesting to watch, but at the same point too, it's definitely losing its relevance as a really good, you know, information tool. And that's just for me, but I think that's for a lot of people. So if advertisers are saying, we're a little scared about this, how long is it going to be before it kind of implodes, you know, or is there some secret idea behind the scenes that nobody knows about? That's literally the $44 billion question.
And Steve, just our last minute and a half or so, a lot of layoffs from Twitter and Meta / Facebook.
Yep.
A lot of talented people out there now probably looking for work. Do you see maybe an opportunity for someone to come out of nowhere with a big new social media platform that we don't even know the name of today?
Possibly. You know, it all comes down to, you know, they can launch something new, like Be Real. That came out in the last year or so. The big question is a lot of social media apps come out, they get popular for 6 months, and then once the newness wears off, they wither on the vine and die. So these social media apps, really, they're businesses. You have to have a business model to support it. And that's the thing, is people raise venture capital, they launch an app, and then they discover they don't have a way to sustain it, and the whole thing collapses. So will there be more apps? Yes, there will be. Is there going to be one that's going to become the next Twitter? I don't know about that. I really don't see, you know, a different business model other than subscription or ad supported that would even allow a new app like that to even exist. So unfortunately, I think we're stuck with what we have.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Great. Thanks again, Rob.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing instructor at Madison College. He joined us to talk about changes in how people are using social media and what apps are gaining popularity. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, two UW-Madison journalism professors joined the show to talk about the state of civil discourse, in some cases the lack of same, and how to revitalize it here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.